Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. I love your Canadian theme. That's awesome.
Got to support, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I almost should have some Calgary stuff in here because we're both from Calgary.
That's true, yes. Yeah, you're a native Calgarian as well.
I am.
Awesome, yeah.
Yeah, how was your weekend?
It was lovely. Yeah, it was busy, full of lots of social stuff with friends and family, but that was really nice. Yeah, and it's just gorgeous out. Before I came up to do the podcast, I was sitting outside enjoying the sunshine. It's just beautiful.
I know we kind of talked about addiction, and I think that's such a, it's always been important, but I think now more than ever, it's something that, you know, should be at the forefront. You know, why do we get addicted to things? And like, not just drugs and alcohol, it's social media, it's TV, it can be anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's such a multifaceted area that's why, I know, if we want to go down some specific rabbit holes, we certainly can. But I think my general focus in my practice is on addiction more generally. And yeah, as you said, I see people who struggle with addiction related to anything. And even people who've been in recovery for years, decades, with one aspect of addiction, they notice that energy is still there and creeps into other things. And so that's why I do think it's really important that people understand what addiction is, because we can get caught up in looking at these small facets of it, right? That, oh, it's just about opioids or alcohol or spending or food, when really, if you have a brain that's vulnerable with addiction, which many of our brains are, and most of us have the genetics in us that create that predisposition, then we're vulnerable. So I think it's important that we understand where that vulnerability can lie.
For sure. And I think addiction oftentimes, you know, you can end one, but then like it transpires into another, doesn't it? It's almost like, well, I'm not drinking anymore. Now what's your obsession? Is it work? Is it?
Yeah.
Now, when we look at obsession and addiction, would you say very similar?
Very similar, if not even identical sometimes. I think there can be obsession in other areas, perhaps. I don't know. Yeah. But I do believe that addiction is basically a brain that gets overly and easily attached to things, which when we look at what obsession is, essentially that boils down to addiction, obsession. But I think for some people, they identify as having maybe obsessive compulsive disorder or something like that. And they don't really see that falling under the addiction umbrella. I personally do feel that there's a relationship there, and that if we're treating one, that we can look at the other. But for some people, they are opposed to that. So, okay, I'm not going to push on their belief system too much. But I do believe that for someone who struggles with more of an anxiety-related kind of OCD, that it is important that they look at how else their brain may be getting attached to things and what else their brains might be getting attached to, because generally there are some other obsessions or attachments, if you will, that come up along the way that if they address those might actually help them in their recovery with the OCD that they're struggling with.
For sure. Where do you think addiction stems from? Is it nature or is it nurture?
Current understanding is it's definitely a combination of both, but more heavily weighted, it seems, on the nature side. So studies seem to peg it anywhere from about 60 to 80% is the general range that seems to be landed upon by researchers. That's down to genetic factors. So that leaves anywhere from 20 to 40%. That's the environment and those nurture factors. So, of course, we're complex human beings, right? It's always going to be a combination of the two. But there's definitely a huge influence from our genetics, which I think is important for people to realize and understand, because that's something that we don't have influence over, right? Like, we're not all sitting there as we're getting born and checking off which genetics we're going to get and which ones we're not. Parents aren't doing that either. So there has to be some acceptance for that biological factor, whereas with addiction, we tend to be very blaming and blamey to ourselves with having it. And that's something that I do hope will change, that people will see this is a genetic, it's a physiological condition that we need to treat just like we would any other physical and genetically based condition, not just blame and judge and shame people and expect that they can control their behavior.
When you look at addiction itself as a whole, do you think it's also to do with past trauma?
That can definitely fall into the environment side of things, right? That if you look at trauma, it's a pretty wide spectrum. And that language of adverse childhood events gets used, or ACEs, to look at how broad of a spectrum that can be. Because what may be traumatizing to you may not be traumatizing to somebody else, and vice versa. So trauma sort of is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak. And it definitely can be one of those factors that I liken it to a light switch. It almost can turn on that light, but did it create the infrastructure and the circuitry for that light to be there and to be turned on in the first place? No, that's the genetic and the biological factor. But did it play a role in activating that? Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Yeah. How does someone know that they have an addiction or they have an issue in regards to obsession?
Yeah, I think there are lots of clinical assessment tools and questionnaires and things like that out there. But I think that the people in the 12-step program say it best when they say that addiction really is a self-assessed condition, because it is important that the person themselves feel like they're in a place that their life is being negatively impacted enough that they feel motivated to make change. And so if a person feels that they have enough obsession or addiction that warrants taking some steps to better themselves, to me, that's far more important and significant than how many boxes they check on a questionnaire. And for them, I hope that people will realize that you don't have to be at the severe end of the spectrum of being homeless, unemployed, basically non-functional in one's life before you can feel that you qualify for having problematic obsession or addiction. I've had some people that can just be even with their thinking that they feel it's too much. They ruminate too much, or they dwell on things too much. And if that's a problem for them, great. I don't think we necessarily need to do as much labeling as we do, that we just need to help meet people where they're at. And if someone wants to make an improvement and a change, great, then let's meet them where they're at and support them in doing that.
It's interesting in this day and age, social media and all these things that we have, where, you know, if you have something, sometimes you can be shamed. And it's so easy to point a finger at someone without looking back at yourself and saying, well, who am I to judge somebody else's life and livelihood? Yeah.
Totally. Yep. Yeah, and I think that's definitely the downside of social media. Not that I have to defend social media in any way. I have no investment in doing that. But I will say, I think that can also at the same time be the upside of what social media has provided. Is it definitely, at least from what I'm seeing, is opening up way more conversation about mental health and addiction. And it may not always be the most accurate information out there, but I think when people are sharing their stories and their experiences, even just to get that conversation rolling and to make it more public, is actually really helpful, because addiction in the individual certainly thrives in secrecy and isolation. And that's really where society has been at for so long, is addiction has lived in the quiet, dark, secretive corners of society. And that's what led people to think that, well, I can't possibly have addiction because I don't look like this stereotypical image that I've been told by society and by media. But if they can start seeing, oh, that person that I would have previously thought totally successful, totally healthy, no issues. Oh, well, if they're talking about a mental health or addiction issue, maybe that will make people more willing to look at some of their stuff and earlier before it starts to progress and become a moderate or severe issue, right?
The other thing is, I think opening yourself up to the world and being vulnerable is a scary thing because fear of judgment. And oftentimes the thoughts around, well, will my employer see this and now let me go? Or will my friends or social circles view me as some outsider because now, oh, this person has an addiction. And that's something that people get nervous about. So it's a bottle waiting to pop, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. And it definitely takes a tremendous amount of courage and strength. And as you said, vulnerability to be willing to go public to that extent. Like you said, when you're on social media, where really anyone could see it, right? As much as we have filters and privacy and all that yes. kind of stuff. But on a smaller scale, I do talk with individuals that I work with in session about smaller versions of disclosure and being open. So maybe you don't emblazon it on a t-shirt that you wear on your next social media reel that like 1,000 people see, but maybe you open up a more real conversation with a close friend or a trusted confidant. And even that in and of itself is really powerful for the individual who's sharing, but also for societal change, because even those one-on-one conversations start to break down some of those stereotypes and that judgment and allows people to start to see, oh, if my friend that I have the utmost of respect and love for is talking to me about some stuff they're struggling with, well, now maybe I'll feel more comfortable to talk with them. And now we are having more societally open conversations. So whether it's on that big stage of social media, definitely doesn't have to be that, even on that small stage of just someone in your life that you feel safe and comfortable with, I just hope people will get talking.
Yeah. Why is this of interest to you, this topic specifically, addiction?
You know, I think it just came serendipitously yeah. as the best things in life do. I kind of stumbled into it at a critical time in my life where I was reevaluating my career and next steps with my career. And lo and behold, as the best things in life do, it's taught me a lot. And it actually showed me how vulnerable I am just from the family and the genetics and the lineage that I have come from. And so there's definitely lots of untreated addiction in my family of origin. And so I do feel directly impacted by addiction. I don't feel I've ever crossed that threshold myself into anything that felt too extreme or destructive, but definitely like I can feel my brain pull in that direction, that it's wanted to toy that line, especially with, you know, things like anxiety and overthinking things and perfectionism and caretaking in relationships, body image, like all of those things. My brain definitely wants to pull to that extreme and just wants to cross that line. But thankfully, I think there's something in me, which I'm super grateful for. I don't know what it is or where it comes from, that's been holding me back and keeping me a bit more stable. But yeah, it touches on all of us, whether personally in our individual experiences or in family and the people that we're close to. Because yeah, it's been, when I look at it, it's all around me in the people that I know and grew up with. So it had a very direct impact. So it's been really helpful, of course, to learn about it and support others. But of course, it's been tremendously impactful to learn about it for my own life too.
In perspective, and you realize you're not alone. That's the other thing. You know, when you hang out in social circles, nothing wrong with it. It wasn't serving me, but some people can just enjoy it and go to a pub and be okay. I wasn't okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
that's an amazing stat, actually, just about alcohol. And it's from the UK. So I'm not sure where this sits in Canada, but we saw a recent survey that approximately 25% of people aged 19 to 25 in the UK are choosing not to drink. Which is amazing, right? When you think about the culture over there, I think it's, I don't know if you'd say it's a little bit more based around alcohol than here in Canada. I think in some ways it is, but and for sure in Canada, we're very socialized around alcohol. So I think that's a really cool trend just to see people who are chosen sober.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I did see that because I was looking for some non-alcoholic beers and that popped up. A few months back. Yeah. I didn't know the stats itself, but it said, there's a rising trend of young people changing their minds on if they want to drink or not. And I thought that was kind of neat.
I've been a non-drinker myself for years. I don't actually have a number on it, but just with knowing how vulnerable I am with my family of origin and then the work that I've been doing, I just didn't feel like it had any place in my life. So I happily let that go. But I don't really enjoy non-alcoholic beverages. So I haven't sought that out. So that's interesting. But I hope that's something that changes. Like, I'd like to see that sober culture bigger here. I know some places in the States, they are opening up like sober bars and sober venues where people can go and socialize and have that experience without having to worry about the triggers and the dangers that can come with alcohol being around. So that's awesome.
Yeah. For myself, you know, if I have friends around me, they'll drink and it doesn't affect me at all. And I don't think about it, but you know, there are moments where you're like, oh, you can slip in a second. Totally. Right? That inner voice can say, come on, man, you're good. Look, everyone's good. Yeah. Just things are going well. Have a drink.
Right? Totally.
The other thing is the socially acceptable to make mistakes when you're drinking versus not. Right. Oh, he was drunk or she was drunk. It's okay. But there's a reality in it.
Yeah. But up to a certain point, I would say, like, definitely as people progress in alcoholism, it's almost like all of a sudden the tide will turn. And I think that's really unfair, right? Because people have been sort of enabled and given this free pass and even given a pat on the back that, oh, yeah, like, you were hilarious and you did all this silly stuff when you were drunk. But then as soon as it turns into a not so fun direction, then all of a sudden, what I've heard a lot from people is all of a sudden they're just dropped almost like a hot potato, right? Like, as soon as the going really gets tough, if they do have a particularly bad experience, now all of a sudden people aren't laughing about that, but not only are they not laughing, they're not even around anymore. They're quick to just run away from that person.
Obviously, the first step to a lot of things in life is knowing that that is an issue, that is a problem for you. What are the next steps? You know, we know, okay, great. I have for myself, drinking was a problem. Owning up to it was my choice. And same with what I was going to do about it. But for any other individuals out there, I wouldn't recommend things I did to kind of, I put myself through hell to get to.
Not the recommended
plan. No, that's not a good remedy. So what are some things people can do once they recognize I have an addiction problem, a substance abuse problem? An addiction, like you said, doesn't have to be drugs or alcohol.
I think the next step after some awareness is to get learning and to get actioning. So for some people, I've noticed they do like to learn a little bit more what they're up against before they feel ready to start taking some concrete action steps. So they will be the type of people who are doing lots of internet searching to just learn more about addiction, maybe their particular manifestation of addiction. They might be reading some books. They might be listening to podcasts. Like, they really absorb themselves in the knowledge and the database, which then helps to show what action steps feel like they're calling them as the next step. I find other people, they just want to hit the ground running. And so those are the people that they definitely can be learning through some of those tools and resources, but they also are the ones more likely to then go and maybe have a conversation with a doctor or another healthcare provider, or maybe they even start seeking out some like groups or some support for that particular issue. And a very common starting point is to start to change physical habits, because no matter what type of addiction we're dealing with, most people notice that various aspects of their health get eroded as that process continues. And probably the easier, I'm not saying it's easy, but probably the easier and more tangible area to start is physical health. So I noticed that people will all of a sudden just start to make some gains with maybe an exercise, body movement routine, maybe start consuming more water, really focusing on rest, like doing some of those things that are very tangible, that we feel good when we're doing and that we see some benefits from. And then that can set the stage for either more learning, or can set the stage for those other changes that can also be of benefit for addiction, which would mean looking at relationships, looking at how people cope with stress and emotion, and also starting to explore the topic of spirituality as well. So not necessarily religion, but just looking at their ideas about connection and what that means and what that is for them. So definitely starting somewhere that feels a little bit tangible, I think, is helpful, so that people feel there's something they can kind of sink their teeth into and notice some progress. Because as you know, it's such a tough slog, especially in the early days. So to have something that's providing a little bit of validation, hopefully some immediate, especially physical benefit, can really help people to keep going with that motivation to get through the early part of that transition from active addiction into recovery, because it's the worst time, the worst state for a human being to be in is detox and withdrawal. And no matter what kind of addiction you're dealing with, as you're moving from that active state to recovery, you're going to go through that period. So you need whatever is going to help and support you the best to transition through that.
I think it was, November 25th, 2020 was the day I kind of said, I'm done. When you look at hyper-focus, now is that addiction or not?
Again, everyone you talk to is going to have a different perspective on that, but I personally do feel and have observed that addiction is a very broad umbrella, and there's lots of different symptoms and experiences that fall underneath that. And in what I've observed, hyperfocus is definitely one of those, and that also connects to what we would call ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which also has many different faces and manifestations. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's just one type of ADHD, but there's a very strong connection. And that's where if you talk to someone who treats addiction, they're more likely to say, well, ADHD is a symptom within addiction. But if you talk to someone who's an ADHD practitioner, they would say, well, ADHD is the condition that we need to treat because it can lead to addictive behaviors. So I'm not really here. I'm just one person with one perspective. I can't end that debate fully because I don't have that power. But obviously, there's a link between them. So wherever you fall, whether you're someone who's looking more at it from an ADHD perspective or someone who's looking at it more from an addiction perspective, really, a lot of the treatment wisdom and the action steps for change are very similar. Mm-hmm. And so it's just important that individuals find the type of support that makes the most sense to them and that they feel most comfortable with is really what it boils down to.
So Paige, if someone has an addiction issue and they somewhat resolve it, is it a band-aid or is it cured?
From everything that I've learned and observed, I can't confidently say that addiction can ever be cured. When you really dig into what addiction is, there's some issues in the core reward circuitry of our brains. And as much as we can sort of try and create some different pathways, change how our brains are acting and reacting to things, the reality is that there's always going to be a different level of functioning at that core primal level of the brain. There's just no way that we've discovered yet to go into that part of the brain that's so deep down in the brain, how it works, that we can remedy that completely. So I feel that the best that we can hope for is a continued state of recovery and health. And I don't mean that to sound negative or pessimistic in any way. I would actually say that in terms of the quality of life that's possible for people who have addiction and who enter into recovery, it's probably the highest of any chronic disease that's out there. And I would even go so far as to say people who have moved from addiction into a state of continued recovery can even have a better quality of life probably than other people, because most people who don't recognize that issue, they're just bumbling along and really haven't learned a lot of the tools and the skills that recovery can offer. But yeah, I don't think that a cure is possible given just how our brains work and what we're up against.
When you look at someone that has that personality type, the addictive personality, I have heard this before where they say, well, you know, no, I can't do this because I have an addictive personality, or I can't do this.
First off, I actually don't agree that it's a personality thing. I believe that a person's personality sits separate from these issues that exist in the brain. I know that our brain, it kind of all mushes together at a certain level, but to me, it is pretty clear as you really get to know the face of addiction that it's very different. It's just a set of symptoms that exist separately from the core of who people are. And that's what recovery is there to help people do, is bring forward who they actually are. Right. And therefore, that would be experiencing life in a very multifaceted, diverse way. So do you have to be mindful of what triggers you? Yes. Do you need to have boundaries with certain things? Yes. But boundaries doesn't mean not engaging with things. Boundaries can mean just engaging with things in a way that feels safe and in balance for you. So there might be a few things that people in recovery will identify that they don't want to do simply because it just feels too risky and kind of counterproductive. And basically the downsides outweigh the costs of doing it. But I've never met anybody that's the whole of their lives, right? That's usually a couple of things. And then the rest of things they're happy to enjoy and or enjoy with boundaries and those thoughts in mind about what parts of that behavior or activity are okay for them and which parts aren't. But yeah, recovery is about a very diverse and enjoyable life. So one can't just remove all of these things in their lives and hope that they'll be okay, because likely then their mood will plummet. They'll feel isolated. They'll feel sad. They'll feel deprived. And that's just the setup for addictive behavior to come back in whatever form it's going to.
Why are you seeing now more than ever people on social media come out and tell their stories rather than when we look at, you know, our parents' age or grandparents' era? It was a different time, wasn't it?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, it is really heartening to see. Like, I like when people share their stories, and I think it's really unfortunate if people do get pushback or judgment or those old stereotypes that come. And I really hope that that won't dissuade them from continuing on in their journey and with sharing. And I hope that that doesn't prevent other people from sharing as well, because my experience is that it generally is a pretty welcoming and supportive community out there in social media when it comes to mental health. You, just like any social situation, you just have to be in the safer places. Right?
We're literally one step away from the other side of the road when you're talking about mental health, because you don't know what people are going through. And, you know, oftentimes the most happy-go-lucky individuals on social media can be struggling as well.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
When you think that you got it or they've got it all, you don't know their story.
Yeah, Robin Williams comes to mind when you say that. I think he was one of the more public figures, but I'm sure anyone who saw him or met him just sees that exuberant, jovial, always kind of funny and laughing person, but clearly someone who struggled with addiction and mental health.
Yeah. And that guy, great movies, he was the best. A lot of laughs, Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yep, classic. Yes. Watched that a couple of times when I was young, for sure.
Oh, my God, there's so many now.
Yeah. I appreciated what he would even talk about with addiction and mental health, but then to have his life ended so early, it's just really sad to see. I think that's just such a good example of how you never really know what's going on behind the scenes, right?
And Paige, if people want to get in touch with you and, you know, see where to start here in terms of their own addictions in life, how do they do so?
Pretty easy to get a hold of me. Best ways are send me an email, which you can do through my website. You can direct message me through Instagram. I am on other social media platforms as well. So I'm on TikTok. I don't tend to get a lot of direct messages through there, but you could shoot me one through there if you wanted to. I'm also on Facebook, but the best way is I have a really user-friendly website, so people can go on there. You can call me, you can text me, you can email me, and you can even book appointments directly through my website. So it's a super easy process, and I haven't been taking new clients for a while now, and I just opened up my website today that I can accept a few new people over the next little while. So fantastic. If somebody who's listening or interested wants to learn more, you can certainly set up a consultation call with me. There's lots of ways to get a hold of me. Probably the direct one is by email or by phone.
Do you do virtual?
I do, yeah. I do a combination. So I generally work all my days in my office. Yeah. But I do a mixture of in-person, virtual, and some phone sessions as well. So basically, whatever is the most user-friendly to the client, it's up to them to decide.
Sure. Nice. Okay. Well, thank you for your time today, Paige.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun, and I enjoyed seeing where our conversation went.